Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, September 10th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight we've got money and markets, then great questions and asks Catherine, and then an extended precious metals market. We're not going to do a movie tonight. We've got extra time because so much has been happening. We want to make sure we cover it all with Franklin. Our theme tonight is currency wars, because so much of what's in the news, as you can see, everybody's competing to not be disadvantaged by the currency they're using or to start their own currency or to change to a currency system that will advantage them. And we suspect that what we're watching is just the beginning of something that's going to intensify for quite some time. So let's start with money and markets. The most important story this week was the dollar hit a low for the year, not a low for all time, and we're not even close to the dollar's low, but dollar low for this year, and gold spiked through 1,000. It's back down in the 990s today and yesterday, but it did spike through. Second story is China. We've had, a possible theme for this week could be Asia rising. We saw China make a whole series of announcements that really indicate a shift in the global economy to a whole new Asian-centric place. China has announced they're going to issue offshore bonds in their own currency. That's step one to establishing your currency as really an alternative as a reserve currency. We've had at one of the last IMF meetings, the IMF agreed they were going to issue special drawing rights, and China investing $50 billion in special drawing rights last week. We saw continued announcement, as we've seen for months now, of China laying off their U.S. dollar reserves by making all sorts of deals to lock up commodities and strategic resources around the country, around the globe. An announcement that the market capitalization of the 500 largest companies in China have, as a market cap, surpassed the largest U.S. 500 companies, a very important signal of the shift to Asia, partly reflecting that there is an investment bubble in China. It's kind of like we have bubbles traveling the world looking for a safe place to go. Perhaps the most important China story was two things that are probably connected. You have the Chinese literally encouraging their enormous population to invest in gold, and indications that they and the sovereign funds are buying gold. So a real push to encourage gold at the same time that the Chinese state enterprise regulator is encouraging the state-owned enterprises, both shipping and the plane company, the airlines, who had made derivatives for oil to hedge their fuel costs, encouraging them to default or abrogate those contracts or use legal mechanisms to not honor those contracts. That could be very bad news for Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, the big derivative players. You wonder, though, if their encouragement of the rising gold price wasn't part of their negotiation to get out of the oil derivatives, because the gold positions are significant positions for those big banks. And so you wonder if that's not part of the derivatives war. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about what happened with Barrick Gold and the gold derivatives when we get to precious metals with Franklin. Another very important story, we have a UN group coming out in Geneva with an announcement that they want a call for a global currency. One of the descriptions is that the new kind of system they're looking at would be a step up from the special drawing rights, the SDRs being what the Chinese invested $50 billion in. So another move to a currency. The interesting thing is if you read their pronouncements and their discussions, it's all up on the blog, and all the stories I'm going to mention tonight are up on the blog. What you realize is they're saying we can't conduct real businesses and real trade of real things in the material economy if we have to use a currency, which is literally a football for financial speculation. So we need a currency that is not primarily a vehicle for financial speculation. Of course, what they mean is we, the real economy, are tired of subsidizing a variety of players through the currency mechanism. And so a lot of, you know, there are other agendas behind the group, but a lot of what they're saying is certainly, from a financial standpoint, sound. One of the stories that came out this week, it's up on the blog, and it's called Arms Dealers for the Star. I've talked before, and we got a wonderful question about when you say the military holds up the dollar. This is another part of the military holding up the dollar. There was a congressional study that just came out that indicated that the U.S. economy, let me get the exact numbers, the U.S. economy is now controls 68% of the global arms business, and in fact, that business was up 50% over the last year. So while the arms business was down globally because of that of the recession and economic problems, our arms business is up significantly. This business is very important to America. So again, an indication that we're shifting to a war economy, and really the United States is developing a global core competency in basically war and arms, and our economy is very dependent on it. Health reform, the president made a speech last night. I'm not going to go into the details of health reform. I've said this before. I'm going to say it again. We are all much better off if health reform fails. My prediction is that health reform will be used to do a couple things. One is, it's a taxation system that will force everybody to spend a certain amount of money to finance the current healthcare system in a way that's not in their interest, number one. Number two, it will be a way to cut the current Medicaid and Medicare benefits. So if you are a recipient or soon to be recipient of Medicare and Medicaid, you're going to be much worse off. Three, it's going to get you in the database and allow the government to control significant more or bigger parts of healthcare policy, healthcare practice, and the healthcare industry, period. So health reform is going to be bad. Clearly, it's a major agenda on the Democratic agenda. Whether or not it will pass, who knows? We have a mid-year election this year. It's hard to imagine that both health care and the federal budget, which needs to be wrapped up by October 1st, and cap and trade and food safety and a number of other these things can all get through. But health reform is clearly number one on the agenda. Who will stop it? It's not clear right now. I hope it does get stopped. Another study came out. It's up on the blog. I won't go into detail. Basically, what it shows is the vast majority of the gains in the United States over the last 15 years went to the top 1%, and remarkably little went to the bottom 90%. That's not new news, but it's tremendous documentation of, I think, something that certainly the subscribers of the Solaria Report already understand. Finally, a little news peeked through on the ongoing struggle between Israel and Iran and the danger of not only war but nuclear war. We saw last week stories of Blackwater, whose name is now changed, in Pakistan. Speculation was that the Americans were putting them there in case of war between Israel and Iran so that they could protect and make sure that the nuclear arsenal there didn't fall into the wrong hands. Another story that peeked through was indications in some of the Israeli press that the Prime Minister of Israel had gone to Russia to meet with Putin. Again, hard to glean anything from it, but I think the wild card story between now and the end of the year may be what is going on behind the scenes between Israel and Iran. So that's it for money and markets. We're going to see this theme of currency war is going to continue, particularly as we see the folks who want to centralize do so and try and use currency and a move to global currency to centralize, whereas a whole variety of parties from communities to other countries are going to realize the benefits if they can build up and maintain and control their own currency. So a lot of this centralization, decentralization is going to play out through currency wars. So this has just begun. Okay, so Ask Catherine. We had so many wonderful questions, and again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your questions. They are fascinating. I'm going to defer some to Franklin for the precious metal segment. Let me just mention several questions we got for prior guests. They come in after the presentation. One related to our last Solari report for Dr. Laura Thompson on how to protect yourself, build your immune system. Someone asked, can I trust vitamins that are sold at Costco? And someone else asked why she hadn't mentioned colloidal silver, and so I asked her to respond, and here's what she said. Long answer, but basically most vitamins sold at Costco are of poor quality. Now and then you'll stumble on something good. I don't recommend colloidal silver on an ongoing basis because it can cause toxicity. The best way to go with colloidal silver is to use it in rotation with other natural antibiotics. The problems with generating it yourself is that it renders an inconsistent parts per million and doesn't absorb as well. At any rate, it's all about boosting the immune system, and colloidal silver doesn't do that. It's a great natural antibiotic, but not an immune strengthener. That is why I recommend a variety of products in the categories of immune strengtheners: lymphatic support, gut support, natural biotics, antivirals, and antifungals. Some products cover many bases. If you didn't listen to Dr. Laura Thompson's presentation, it's in the archive, and it's very, very good, and not only pertinent to swine flu, but any ill that could, you know, sort of, that we face physically, because building your immune system is something that addresses every ill. Then a question for Cliff High of Half Past Human related to what are the safe places to live, and specifically referring to north of 40. So those of you familiar with Cliff's work know the particular language he uses to speak. So let me just write to you exactly in the words that he responded. Catherine, first, north of 40 has been showing up in the movements by the powers that be for what appears to be minion class and slave class installations in deep underground facilities, while the powers that be themselves are going south of 30 and or to very high elevations. To give you a sense of these numbers, I'm in Tennessee, which is about a latitude of about 35. Is that latitude or longitude? Anyway, two, north of 40 has been seen repeatedly in planning documents coming from RAND et al. And other subs for DOD. There are also some resources being allocated by minion class military and politicals to north of 40. Also note the location of the seed vault. The seed vault that he's referring to is the seed vault being financed by the Rockefeller and Gates Foundation in Norway. A very interesting thing, if you haven't read about it, we've touched on it before. There are posts on the blog about the Norwegian seed vault. We have no specific locations extracted from our data sets as safe, and I dispute the concept. Universe, in my experience, moves as it sees fit. Almost no amount of hiding in a hole in the ground will extend anyone's life by any amount. Karma just doesn't work that way. The opposite is also true, that is to say that nothing can take your life if it opposes universe karma plan for you. Thus, the numerous instances of people surviving horrific situations in which many others perish. These individuals were simply not part of the set that universe karma selected to die at that point in time. So basically my thinking is that if I were to go to the center of a hurricane knowingly and universe had not chosen me to perish that way that day, no amount of hurricane could do the job of killing me. Probably a screwy way to consider universe, but I've had too many personal examples of not dying to come to any other conclusion. So we aren't universe's travel agents and don't recommend places. What we recommend is centering such that a person may learn to listen to the universe better. Also, universe demonstrably rewards acts of courage. Anyway, so that's it from Cliff High. I agree with him tremendously in that I found if you're where your heart is, if you're where you're supposed to be, and you're doing everything you can to build safety for the people around you, that somehow that attracts a very natural kind of safety. And so it's more about what you're doing and how you're doing it than exactly where you are. So two questions. Let me run through some others. What happens to a global commodity stock when the dollar totally tanks? And the specific question was asking in reference to an oil stock. And this is a great question, because sometimes I will find that people think if the pricing on a stock is denominated in dollars, that somehow it's going to fall if the dollar falls. If the company has a hard asset which is holding its value in that kind of circumstance, like a natural resource company or a precious metals bullion trust, where the bullion is really there. In fact, it doesn't fall with a dollar. It holds its value. So the price goes up, not because the purchasing power has gone up, but because the dollar is falling. And that's why it's very important sometimes when the stock market is rising not to think that that's a sign of a stronger corporate economy, rather to realize it's just related to inflation and the dollar falling. Another question that I mentioned earlier that we got, could you elaborate on the military holding up the dollar? This is a conversation that I could talk about for hours and hours and hours. It's really talking about how you ensure that other people buy or hold your currency or your securities by using force. And that force can be physical force, that force can be economic force. And one of the most beautiful descriptions I've ever seen of sort of how the military holds the dollar up is the movie Syriana. I find movies to be wonderful examples of how to kind of explain this point. So for the person who asked that question, if you haven't seen Syriana, please watch it, because it's a great example of how a country's economic development strategy has nothing to do with what makes economic sense, but literally to do with what the United States has ordered, and if it's not followed, of course, the leaders are taken out literally with a missile that comes down on their heads. Another question from a subscriber, what do you think about foreign dividend stocks per Peter Schiff strategy? Peter Schiff is the head of Euro-Pacific, which is a brokerage company, and it's a company I've had numerous interactions with. Their strategy is basically focused on equities that are in infrastructure, basic business, and produce very good dividend yields. And the countries that they choose to find stocks in are basically Asia and Europe, no Africa, no Latin America, some Canadian, and so in that sense, North America, but very focused on Asia. Their feeling is the way to take advantage of the Asian boom is rather invest in the more speculative emerging markets, invest in the mature economies that are derivative to that, so Singapore, Hong Kong, et cetera. Now, if you look at the long run, if you believe in buying stocks, for that, you know, for a portion of a portfolio or investment that's in equities, it's a sound long-term strategy. Problem right now, of course, is we're seeing, I would argue, real bubbles in the equities market. So, of course, the question is, you know, when do you want to go in that? But there's much in that strategy that lends itself. And we're going to talk to the sort of the long-term trends. We're going to talk more in the precious metal segment about the relative pricings of equities here and around the country. We're seeing tremendous arbitrage differences between North American and American equities and those in Asia and Europe. So great questions. Keep them coming. More questions with Franklin. So precious metals market report. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay. We just had a great dinner. Anyway, my wish for the subscribers is that they should eat as well as you and I do. Anyway, so we've had quite a week in the precious metals market, Franklin. What can you tell us?
Well, it was astonishing. Monday, of course, we had gold over $1,000. And in the last week, of course, gold was up roughly $50 on the week, about 4%. Silver was up 10%. It was fantastic.
Silver has been flying.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not like those people. A fellow that works with me came in a couple of days ago, and he said, well, those guys on Bloomberg were talking about how gold had gotten up here and it might correct back to 950. No. If gold breaks 970, it has trouble. it must go through $1,000. There's no such thing as a triple top. You don't make a triple top and then go through the resistance area. Gold has to go forward now. Now, what locks
now,
that?
That's true, even though it's back down into the
900s. It's back down a little bit, but, you know, as long as it's not doesn't go below, mid-970s or $970, we're okay. And what it's doing is it's sort of, if you could see it on a chart, it's sort of bumping up against this ceiling of $1,000. And it's been very enthusiastic. Somebody underneath it is willing to buy every time it goes down. The low today was about $983.
Well, you know the Chinese announced that's what they were doing.
Well, apparently they're not the only one. the way it looks. So I think what you're going to see is this. Let me go back and say first, what locks it in for me is that the dollar, which for a couple of months we've been watching and thinking, okay, is the dollar going to stage a sudden rally? Is the surprise rally going to come? And that, of course, would put a hole in gold and silver and condemn them to another 6 months of correction. Well, the dollar has answered that question. It broke 78.33 resistance, which had been important. And then even more important than that is 77.50. All of that's been broken this week. The dollar index was about 77.30 today. And so it's broken. And from a technical standpoint, then the next logical step is for the dollar index to sink to about 74 if you look at the chart. Now, one of the things that you and I understand, Catherine, and that all of your listeners ought to understand is that currency exchange rates are manipulated.
Right.
So, you know, when they have supper the first week of the month, all the central bankers there at the Bank for International Settlements, they get together and they don't talk about the chicken dinner. They talk about how they're going to manipulate their currency exchange rates. So I think the policy for the U.S. dollar since at least 2001 has been to manipulate the dollar downwards. I think we can expect that to continue, although they're not going to let it drop drastically.
Right. Well, they've pulled it up for the last, you know, ever since the Lehman debacle, they've pulled it up amazingly.
Right. But if you look at those rallies, they generally speaking, they lack enthusiasm. Now,
right.
Normally across the summer, liquidity drops. That is, the number of dollars out there drop, and that tends to buoy the dollar up. But it's not working now. I mean, the number of the dollar index is very definitely broken down from a technical standpoint. If once gold gets through $1,000, and I think this is the big it's the great market event of this fall, gold is going to head, once it goes through $1,000, $1,010, it will head for $1,325. That's not just Franklin's crazy idea. That is the measured target. If you look at the formations on the gold chart, the pennant and the reverse head and shoulders, the measured target is about $1,300. So when it makes that move, it'll be very fast, and then we'll go into a correction that will last, you know, 12 or 15 months. But it will be the last time you'll see gold under $1,000. And silver, of course, is moving not just right along with it, but silver is actually moving ahead of gold. Last week, silver was up 10%, gold was up 4%. So we're right at a point. Probably you're going to see gold go through $1,000 before the end of September if it keeps going like it is. Now,
right, we saw it peak through.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in 2008 and then back down. So the question is, can we establish a new floor at 1,000?
Well, I think that's what's happening. You know, the way the Fed and the federal government, the Treasury Department work, they defend a line in the sand, so to speak. You know, formerly it was gold at $300, and then it was gold at $400, and then it was $450 and so forth. And they defend that line as long as they can, and then they can't defend it anymore, and so they raise the target. And I think that they're about to throw in the target, throw in the towel on the on the $1,000 level.
Now, one of the questions we got was, is it time to swap back into gold? We did a great show on our great Solaria report on trading the gold-silver ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly the ratio has changed a lot with silver really moving up. So is now the time to swap?
I think that we'll probably get that opportunity this fall. Last fall, the gold-silver ratio went out of this world. I mean, it went to 84, which was back to the old high, and that messed up all of my channels and all the targets that I had. But we still have lateral resistance, and the logical lateral resistance is about 51. So when it hits 51, that would be the time I would swap. And the reason I say 51 instead of 50, 50 is the, if you look at the chart, 50 is the obvious resistance. But I got caught on this in 2004. It went down to 51 to 1, and all of the hedge funds were waiting for it to hit 51. They weren't waiting for 50. They swapped out, and 2 days later, it turned around and went back up. So I think we're going to get an opportunity, but it'll probably be, you know, sometime middle of October if it comes then.
Right.
And it may not get down that far. You know, it may only go to 57 and a half or something.
So we should keep an eye out for 55 and lower.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, one of the questions we got, and, you know, this is one I get a lot, I know you get a lot, is will the dollar collapse? Is there a possibility that we're going to see the dollar literally just collapse the way the ruble did or the dollar in Argentina?
You know, I have this good friend, and she keeps saying that they want a slow burn instead of a sudden collapse. and she's just about convinced me that's true. I think that the establishment in the United States, the elite that runs the financial system, is expert at one thing, and that is managing crisis. They do not want a dollar collapse because that throws all the balls up in the air. It creates the potential for social and political violence that they don't want. So I think they're going to bend every nerve and every muscle to make sure that a collapse does not happen. The problem is that, you know, the dollar's value is based wholly on social confidence. And how do you predict what a crowd will do? I mean, you can't. It's like watching a flock of birds in the air. You know, late in the fall in the South, we get these huge flocks of blackbirds. And if you've ever watched them, they'll suddenly all turn.
Right.
Just do a right-hand turn all of a sudden together. How do they know to do that? And crowds are the same way. If confidence breaks in the dollar, then that feeds on itself. It becomes a self-reinforcing cycle, and it could take the dollar down in 10 months or a year.
Well, as soon as the Labor Day was over, it was like somebody had thrown a switch, and everybody was trying to talk the dollar down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Forbes comes out with an article, the dollar collapses, which is ridiculous, because if you look at where the dollar is trading, it's far from its, you know, its all-time low.
Right.
And we have Alan Greenspan, the king of lies, coming out and saying, well, you know, gold really is the ultimate global currency backing.
Mm.
And you think, uh-oh, what's that about? As you watch the BRIC nations try and come up with mechanisms that will allow them to trade, you know, and settle up in their own currencies without the dollar and without the normal settlement systems, and you watch the IMF create the SDRs and China buy the SDRs, what you start to realize is if you're going to transact and trade globally, it's a huge job to create the infrastructure that will permit that outside of sort of the dollar oil system. So there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built, but what the stories are telling us all this week is everybody's proceeding to build them. It's essentially, you know, lots of different ways of working around a falling dollar.
Right, but you've just pointed out one of the strongest assets that the dollar has, and that is that there are 5 billion people who wake up every morning figuring out how they're going to make the dollar work.
Right.
You know, just like they're trying to figure out how they're going to make their lives work and bending every effort toward that, they don't want the dollar to collapse.
Right. 65% of the world reserve currencies are held in dollars.
Right.
Right. So it's kind of like, you know, shorting yourself.
Right. The dollar has a gun up against the entire world's head.
Right.
Yeah.
And the people running it are soaking that for everything it's worth.
Right. Of course.
And everybody knows it. Okay, well, the currency war stories in the precious metals area were many, but maybe if we could start with the Barrick Gold, and you could explain to the subscribers, who's Barrick Gold, what happened, and why is it so important?
Well, Barrick Gold is it began as a little bitty mining company back in the early 80s and put together an enormous portfolio of gold properties and became the largest gold producer in the world, and the person who did that was a fellow named Peter Munk. And in the 90s, gold companies began to think about selling their production forward. In other words, they were faced with a climate where the gold price was in a secular decline, and they mine gold. After all, that's their product. So if they sold their future production forward today, they expected they would get a higher price for it than if they sold it in 6 months when they actually mined it. And that was certainly part of the consideration. But the other part of the consideration was that there was a great price-fixing game going on by the federal government and the bullion banks, and they were trying to sell as much gold as they could get. They would borrow gold, sell it into the market, and then take the proceeds and put it into some higher-paying investment. And it was like stealing money. I mean, it was like, well, not stealing money. It was like backing up the truck, you know, loaded up with free money.
You know, one of my theories is that part of the bailout money went to close out some of those positions.
Well, there's a question, and that's exactly the place that Barrick found itself in. Barrick underwent a huge amount of criticism, especially from the folks at GATA, because Barrick joined in the gold forward sales game. Did they join in partnership? Did they know what was going on? Well, who knows? I wouldn't say that because I can't say that definitely, but they certainly profited from the whole scheme. The problem was that this enormous gold short position was built up all the way across the market, and Barrick had a big piece of it. So,
right, and it's very hard for the Treasury to give bailout money to a Canadian mining company.
Well, they haven't figured out how to do that yet, but they will.
That we know of.
Yeah, and so here's an interesting thing happened. Peter Munk retired, and this new fellow came on. And all of a sudden, day before yesterday, Barrick announces, we're getting rid of all of our gold shorts, which in a market where the gold price is rising makes sense. You don't want to sell it forward because by the time you get it mined, the price will be higher than it is today. And it's as if he came in and he looked around and he said, oh, my goodness, what are we doing with this mess?
Well, he's selling $3 billion of equity, which is a big dilution on their stock.
Right.
To do this, and I think one of the reasons is he woke up and realized he was on the wrong side of China in a derivatives war.
Well, he's certainly on the wrong side of gold.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be short gold when it's hitting $1,000. And I think probably, you know, somebody in their trading department said, look, we got to cut this off. I mean,
right.
we can't let this bleeding continue. And so we've got to have a price where we say, okay, we're throwing in the towel. So they announced they're going to take a $5.6 billion charge off. They're going to float, as you said, $3 billion worth of stock to pay for it. And what it means is it appears to be just an announcement by a company, but it really means this is the end of an epoch.
Right.
This is the end of an era. The whole gold shorting game
is over.
Is over. And when you go in partnership with the government, you lose. That's what the message is. So Barrick is out of that game, and you know, Catherine, they probably had to get out of that game in order to protect demand for their stock.
Well, I think I'm sure that's the case, and they said as much. They said this is a huge drag on the stock. But I think the other part of the story is they had to sell stock to close it out. They couldn't deliver gold.
Right.
So it's a real indication of the possibility of problems in the physical market or potential problems, and I think our next story is as well, and that is the announcement by J.P. Morgan Chase that they are doing an exchange-traded fund for precious metals stored in Switzerland. Now, when this story came in, I was literally hissing. I was like, this is so evil. I can't stand it. I can't stand it. So let me step back and explain to everybody why this is just the height of evil incarnate. We have, over the last 3 months, watched an incredible war waged by the United States against Switzerland. We had, in June, the foreign financial forums. There's a post in the blog about foreign financial institutions forums. But basically, the Treasury and the IRS did a great deal to spook the tax accountancy profession and literally put a chill in Americans investing or depositing money directly abroad. And then we had the settlement with UBS, and we've literally watched for the last couple months while Swiss banks take their American clients and say, here's your money, please leave. We don't want to be subject to American regulation. And then finally last week, as we talked, we had the oldest bank in Switzerland announced that they were advising their clients to get out of all U.S. securities and investments and just completely disgorge themselves as America so that they and the bank could be untouched by American regulation, having survived the Department of Justice, both Franklin and I. We certainly can understand how they feel about that. But now what we have is JPMorgan Chase marketing to Americans the opportunity to invest in precious metals held in Zurich on the theory that Switzerland is the safest place in the world to keep your assets. Their sub-correspondent bank, who they're working with in Switzerland, is UBS. And the message is, as long as you go through us, you can invest in Switzerland. But you can't go direct. You have to go through us. Now, one thing, Franklin, one of the reasons I think this announcement is so stunning is we've started to see money move away from the exchange-traded funds, which, and you and I did a great Soleri report on the exchange-traded funds and how they may not have the gold. And so we've seen money move away from the exchange-traded funds and start to move more towards physical or those arrangements that have, you know, that really have, you know, the market believes on good sort of evidence and facts that the gold is really there. And what, if you look at the J.P. Morgan Chase structure, you can tell they're basically trying to address every criticism that the exchange-traded funds, and what they're saying is, as long as you go through us, you can do this, and it's going to be gold-plated. So we really see a pushback from the boys to kind of get control of that market again.
Right, and again, I think the whole reason for being for the exchange-traded funds and metals is to drain off demand that would otherwise flow into physical metals.
Right.
Because the physical metals just aren't there.
Right, but my guess is one of the things inspiring this is they're really concerned about getting a run on the physical market. And the old products don't satisfy, and they're trying to come up with something that looks and walks and talks much more like the real thing.
Right, and again, at the risk of repeating myself for the 100th time, I've long thought that one of the primary events in this bull market would be the failure of some person who claimed to store silver and gold, and when that failure occurred, that would drive physicals into further backwardation. In other words, that would drive physicals much further than the paper futures price. So that it's just another reason why I think you just have to have the metal. You know, your core position has to be in the metal itself.
Right. One of our questions, in fact, was on backwardization. I can never say it, Franklin.
Backwardation.
It was one of the articles at GATA.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Is permanent backwardation likely if gold futures luring gold sales plays out? What are a few other schemes that might show up to separate us from the metal?
Well, I don't think you – once backwardation takes place, I don't think that there's anything that they can do, because we saw that last fall, for example. Backwardation, of course, is when the price for physical metal for immediate delivery is higher than the price for futures. The futures normally carry – you know, a positive a positive differential between the physicals, because after all, you've got to carry them. You know, you've got an implied interest rate in that, and storage and insurance and all that sort of thing. And whenever the price of metals for immediate delivery goes above the futures price, then that's a backwardation. And what we saw last fall was a backwardation in earnest, and it lasted from September through January.
Right, it was painful.
Right, very painful, because there were times silver, there were some forms of silver that had a 40% premium over the supposed spot price, you know, the paper price, which is what we usually use as a benchmark price. Gold was the same way, all sorts of gold items, and many things just disappeared altogether.
Hence the emergence of a new price, the eBay price.
never mind the spot price, use the eBay price.
An honest market always wants to be happening. I put up a chart on the blog today from August of the... It shows the S&P 500 price-earnings ratio. For those who are not familiar with the price-earnings ratio, it's a ratio that expresses the relationship between a company's income and its equity price. So, for example, if my stock is trading at $10 and I have earnings of a dollar per share per year, then I have a P/E ratio of 10. Anyway, what it shows is that the current P/E ratios are... I mean, they kind of look like one of those roller coasters, right, when it's at the peak and everybody's going, And then Prechter published an equivalent kind of chart with dividends, showing literally that the yield in these stocks that have been pumped up is just, so low for the risk that you're taking. So, I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about what's happening in the stock market, how it compares to fundamentals, and particularly how the U.S. compares to Asia.
Well, I don't know about the U.S. compared to Asia, but I do know about the U.S. market. You know, it is normal, even in a Great Depression, to get a rebound that takes the stock market back to 50% of where it fell off. And... the stock market fell from, we'll call it from 14,000 to 6,500, and the 50% correction level would be about 11,500. So you can see that the stock market hasn't even made that, you know, that ordinary correction yet. It's possible that it can, but it's forming technically this rising wedge, and a rising wedge is like, just think of a triangle that points upward. That's a rising wedge. And normally that kind of formation resolves to the downside.
Right.
So it's not a this is analogous to a patient who is dying with some kind of fever, rousing up in bed, yelling and jumping around, and it does not mean that he's getting better.
One of the things that I did this week was a comparison over Labor Day, a very detailed comparison of yields on high-quality European equities versus Asian equities versus the U.S., and you would have thought that the European and Asian equities were in a currency that was headed for a fall because the yields were so much higher. Mm. It was, you know, the arbitrage was unbelievable, and I can only discern that our markets are enjoying just unprecedented central bank and treasury subsidy, because it's extraordinary. Especially when you consider that they're operating in markets which are growing, and in currencies which are rising, not falling. So big arbitrage. Okay, another chart I put up just very quickly was showing the shrinking of consumer credit. We're seeing just unprecedented reductions both in credit and people reducing their debt. And I don't know if you have noticed that or experienced it in your business. I've certainly seen it around me, but I think it's a very important indicator, along with what's happening with unemployment.
Right. What it tells you is that people are not borrowing.
Right.
And if they're not borrowing, then this money supply is not increasing, because all money has to be borrowed into existence. And that, of course, is exactly what Bernanke is trying to prevent. He's trying to maintain that supply, that level of money creation, which has been dropping. I mean, if you look at the M3 growth rate or the M2 growth rate, it's been dropping. Now, part of that is explained by the fact, by their huge increases that they put in last year. But still, if consumer credit dries up, that means consumer buying dries up, and that's 60 or 70% of the U.S. economy.
Right, and so I think part of the message of all these positive stories about Asia is trying to get everybody to be convinced that the world can survive without the U.S. consumer buying. Well, on to our next topic, which is relocalization. One of the things I asked you to do in the last 2 weeks is to watch a video of Sir James Goldsmith in 1994 being interviewed by Charlie Rose of Bloomberg at a time when he was in America trying to persuade the Congress not to adopt the WTO round, or the round, the Uruguay round that created the new GATT round that created the World Trade Organization. And essentially what he was arguing against was the globalization of agribusiness and the industrialization of land ownership and food production worldwide. And so I consider this to be one of the most important videos I've ever seen in my life. If, for those listening, there are two posts up on the blog. If you do a search for Sir James Goldsmith, you'll be able to pick up the video. It's up on YouTube. You can also buy it in a DVD from Amazon, which I did. But anyway, so I asked you to watch it and got one of the most touching emails from you on your feelings and thoughts, and so I would love it if you would share what you learned.
Well, in the first place, here is this man. This is 15 years ago, and he's not just accurate; he's a prophet. He sees exactly what the WTO is going to do. What it's going to do to developed world economies, and he's absolutely right. And you know, you mentioned part of it. The displacement of farmers and the control and the ceding of control of agriculture to agribusiness, but there was another part, and that was the export of jobs overseas to low-income countries. And he keeps talking about this. I think it's a 47-to-1 wage advantage, you know, wage cost advantage that, for instance, the Chinese have, and that there's no way that Western economies with their high wage rates can compete with that. And so they can't enter into a so-called free market agreement when the wages that they pay are that much different. But the thing that grabbed me the most was a comment that he made when he said, if you force agribusiness on the world, yes, it may be, quote, more efficient when judged by one or two little criteria, but what you're going to do is to drive 1.5 or 2 billion or 3 billion people off the land where they make a living into cities where they cannot make a living. And then he made that comment about the slums in Brazil. The local name is favelas. And he said there were no favelas before agribusiness began to take over Brazil. And that, of course, set my mind back. The same thing happened in the United States. We didn't have slums in the 1930s. But after agribusiness and the god of efficiency took over agriculture, then all of those people became supernumeraries. They were all driven off the land. They were driven into the cities where there were no jobs for them.
Now, you know, I've always confessed this, but I'll confess it again. My grandfather was the dean of social sciences at the Rockefeller Foundation, who literally financed the Green Revolution sort of intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up thinking we'd done this wonderful thing.
but as you know, the Green Revolution backfired.
Right.
The yields dropped. It didn't do what it promised to do. And, of course, it made farmers dependent on seed sources from outside instead of saving their own seed, which means it increased their costs, and it just drives them off the land. And Goldsmith nailed all that.
Right.
He absolutely nailed it.
One of the reasons it's so great is it shows you what I've tried to convince many people of is if you see what happened in the mortgage markets and the housing bubble, you know, that this was all intentional. Everybody knew what was going to happen, and they did it intentionally. It was all very scripted and engineer the Treasury, Greenspan. You know, they wanted a bubble. They engineered bubble. They had to do a lot to push the honest people out of the way. But it was all very intentional. And Goldsmith does a fabulous job of laying that out. This,
right,
this is not some giant accident.
No, no. And he lays all of that out in detail. And the incredible thing is he fights it. Because he comes from the highest level of business organization, you know, the business elite, whatever you want to call it. The man was a billionaire. And yet he sees that this movement, that the adoption of so-called free markets and a tariff-free world is going to destroy the economies of the West.
Right. So what he sees is consolidating wealth shrinks it.
Right.
And he's objecting to something which is more expensive over the whole system. So what he's objecting to is the destruction of wealth in the interest of corporatizing it.
Right. Or as he says, the purpose of the economy is to serve the people.
Right. Now, this is very much in my heart because we're doing the financial permaculture workshop in Hohenwald in the third week, and I'm giving a little course called Mapping Your Financial Ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
And the example I'm going to use is the food stamp program in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
We now have 1 million people in Tennessee on food stamps. There are now 35 million people in the country on food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
In Tennessee, do you know how much we're spending every year on food stamps for those 1 million people?
No.
The budget last year was $1 billion and clearly rising. Now, for those of you who've never visited Tennessee, we have beautiful farmland that lies fallow. Well, those 1 million people are not growing their own food, which they could be doing some of.
Mm.
And so if you look at the economics system-wide, it depends on continuing to pump out Treasury securities to finance enormous expense to pay people to not work while you're shipping their food in from 1,000 miles away, because a lot of this food is now coming in from Latin America. And so it's certainly more efficient for the big agribusinesses, but if you look system-wide at what the government's spending and, you know, the people are eating, it's not more efficient at all. And so that's one of the things we're going to go into is can we price it out? And the absurd thing, of course, in Tennessee is, as you've heard me say before, the customer service has been outsourced to people in India through a contract with, can you guess who the contract is with?
Hmm.
J.P. Morgan Chase. Our old friend. There was, at the top of the blog, there was a wonderful story, and I bring it up because our great question I got and said that I would answer steadily for many weeks was where are the business opportunities? And there was a great story about a variety of different business people who could not get credit because of the banks cutting credit, the economy being poor, and what they did was they went out and encouraged their customers to literally buy credits forward. And in essence, they're arranging both debt and equity financing in their communities with their consumers. It's called Love a Local Business, Buy a Share. And I think it's a wonderful story of the many creative ways that small business can start to connect with the capital in their community. And if we as business people can start encouraging people locally to shift their capital locally, then it doesn't have to go into Wall Street. It doesn't have to go into financing all these shenanigans. And I know, Franklin, you're going to be speaking in South Carolina shortly on relocalization.
Mm-hmm.
And you've certainly grappled with the issue of how do we get capital circulating locally. And I know one of the things you know is it pays to have a currency you can trust.
Absolutely. Well, and that's one of the things that's really dear to my heart, Catherine, is to get people, you know, a lot of people have invested in gold and silver. Those are very foresightful people. They have seen where the future's going. They've made that provision to protect themselves. But you can't bury your talents in the ground.
Right.
You have to put capital to work. And so the ideal situation is for people in their local economies to take that gold and silver capital and put it to work in the local economy, building up businesses in the local economy. And that way, you know, that way there's a double blessing. It blesses them with a return, and it also blesses the economy.
Right. There's one one book, that is a great article. There's an antiventure.com, there's a wonderful book called The Smart Guide,
mm-hmm.
and it's really about all the different ways that people can, small business can finance their business without going to venture capitalists or sort of going to the tapeworm for money, and just hundreds of creative ideas that are very, very good, and some of them described in that article. So check it out, The Smart Guide at antiventure.com. If you're interested in starting up a new business and financing it in ways which are much more in alignment with building equity for you. Okay, next up, I wanted to talk about a couple of Orwellian situations this week. The first one we were talking over at dinner, Michael Moore. And I tell this one in the spirit of helping everyone understand how the world really works. Several months ago, my assistant got a call from Michael Moore's assistant and said, Michael Moore is doing a documentary on the economy and wants to speak with you. Can you come up on Sunday and stay there all Monday? He has lots he wants to cover with you. He wants to learn, not just film. And be prepared, do you mind, to stay over to Tuesday because this could get intense. So I said, no, I'd be delighted. Anything I can do to teach Michael Moore about how the money really works would be fantastic. So we made all the travel arrangements were made, and I had it on my schedule. And then the Thursday before I left, we suddenly got a call from his assistant saying, the meeting's canceled. It won't be rescheduled. Goodbye. Just door shut. And we laughed because this happens to us so much. It's kind of like, okay, well, the boys, Michael Moore got the call and got told, and, that's it. So we didn't think very much of it until we got a Bloomberg article come in this week. And in it, it quotes Michael Moore in the documentary saying that what has happened is, quote, a financial coup d'etat, which is a term I've termed. And then showing up at the door of an investment bank saying he was trying to get the money back. And for any of you who've listened to me over the years, that's my big mantra. We've got to get the money back. So apparently Michael Moore still enjoyed reading my stuff. But I thought I would just give that little tickle because, so many people think of Michael Moore as the great, sort of the great exposer of things. But it just goes to show you that, there are boundaries that he has to pay attention to. It's a dangerous business. Any comment on the Michael Moore story, Franklin?
No, I think that's hilarious. But as I said, when they have to start stealing your material and your definitions, they've lost. The other side has nothing else to say.
Well, my prediction is that Michael Moore didn't start out intending to steal my material. I mean, he used it because... my guess is he got the call.
Right.
So that's my guess.
Yeah.
I don't think, I would not vote for him being, just being about theft. Okay, story number two, I wanted to bring up, I put it up on the blog. IBM had a document posted on the web, which was alleged to be an IBM planning document for the European group for 2006 that indicated that... they wanted their sort of bureaucracies to plan as a contingency 100% chance in the next 5 years that there would be a global pandemic. I point that story out because I was involved for a time with a strategic planning group that did Global Business Network that did planning for the CIA, some government agencies, and some very big corporations. And I finally came to the conclusion after watching scenario planning and strategic planning operate that sometimes when a major operation was planned, but you couldn't tell middle management that it was planned and intentionally planned, you would literally put the idea in a variety of scenario plans and planning and have people plan on it as a contingency basis, and that was sort of the safe way to get your elephants dancing when the time came and you did whatever you did. So the fact that that was, that's an IBM document, the fact that that happened is really not a pleasant sign, but I think important. So check it out. Okay, next up, options for cash when the dollar is falling. I know we've covered this. There's a long Solera report where we go through this in great detail, so I defer you to that, but I thought, Franklin, we'd just touch on that one again.
When the dollar is falling, options for cash.
Uh-huh.
Well, were you thinking about deflation or?
Well, here's what I was thinking about, because I was thinking about, one, pay off your debt, two, demonetize. One of the best investments, I think, is anything you can do to permanently reduce your need for cash. It makes
right.
you much less exposed to the system in a variety of ways. Precious metals, obviously. And then the question is, once you've done those things and you still want money, in liquid form, where do you go?
Well, I'm sort of up against the wall. where do you go? Obviously, the things that you need every day are the things, that's what you want to protect.
Right.
You want to protect your lifeline, which is food, water, place to stay, that sort of thing. Again, of course, paying down debt, one of the things that we talked about, whether there's an inflation or a deflation, you're at an advantage to pay down debt because you're independent. You're outside of the system.
Right.
And in whatever way that you can secure, food, water, daily needs, then whatever money you put toward debt, you've demonetized yourself to that extent.
Right. Well, you lean more to precious metals. I have to confess, I do like high-quality sovereign bonds in countries which are lawful, which is getting to be a shorter and shorter list.
Right. Well, a lot of the people I know, just they invest in lead, and they consider that to be the metal of last refuge. I'm not sure how good an idea that is.
Well, we were going to talk about the remaining calendar, but we're out of time, so I'm gonna defer that to the next Solera report. Franklin, before we close, anything you want to add?
If you're going to buy gold and silver, you better get about it, and you better get out of those dollars, because I really think, Catherine, with the Congress coming back into session, Obama needing to show results, Obama having announced that he's going to reappoint Bernanke, what the signal that they're flashing is we're going to inflate more and more. And
right.
I don't see how that can be avoided.
Right, which means we have to force more and more and more.
Right.
And certainly, from food safety to swine flu to all these different agendas, that's what we're seeing is the kind of control you need to force the things that go along with that.
But I did have one other thing I wanted to say. Someone sent me a quotation today from St. Augustine.
Uh-huh.
And he said something like this: hard times, good times, the times don't matter. We try to live a good life in any times. And I really think that's what the answer is. All times are hard. I mean, all times have their particular challenges. But you just have to bring to them the determination to live well.
Well, I have to tell you, both this summer and just in the last couple of weeks, I see more and more people turning from, sort of the traditional, moving away from the centralized systems and starting to get on with their life in a way that's very positive and developing incredible immunities to the media and all sorts of things. So something very positive continues to go on.
Right, and so I think that's a good thing that comes out of the collapse of a rotten system is that the new thing is born out of it.
Right.
And that's what I want to be part of.
Right. Well, you are. That's why we're talking to you.
And you too.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for our precious metals market report. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, some exciting events. I'm leaving tomorrow for Fargo, North Dakota for the Economic Reality Summit on Saturday. It's free, so if you have friends and relatives in North Dakota, let them know. I'm going to be speaking with Edward Griffith, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Isle, someone I've always wanted to meet, so that's exciting for me. The Financial Permaculture Workshop is going to be September 22nd to 25th. You can learn all about it at financialpermaculture.com. On September 17th, a very wonderful development, we're having Lawrence Gonzalez, the author of Deep Survival on the Solari Report, one of my favorite authors. If somebody said I can only read 10 books to help me in the 21st millennium, what should I read? Deep Survival would absolutely be on that list. It's one of my favorite books and very relevant to helping us understand how to meet the challenges and succeed in any circumstance. On October 1st, the third quarter wrap-up, every quarter I love to take a look back and a look forward, see how we're doing, and then do a year-end wrap-up. So October 1st, very exciting time, so third quarter wrap-up. So that's it for this evening. Remember, don't ask if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.